So should we start this deposition, or do you boys just want to hand us a big bag of money?
Big bag of money.
I think you guys are making a big mistake. I do mostly tax laws and probate stuff occasionally. I got my law degree in night school.
Well, that's fine, Lewis. We got arrested at night.
Now, are you going somewhere with this counselor?
No, not really. I just wanted to upset the witness, Your Honor.
Looks like you did it.
I did it, yeah.
That is a lucid, intelligent, well-thought-out objection.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Overruled.
4 short weeks ago, I was driving truck. Now I'm sitting on the highest court in the land. Thanks to the George Bush Home Study Course, you two could be a Supreme Court Justice.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 572. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. I'm going to go ahead and say not fantastic, Andrew. I'm just going to make that executive decision for you.
Fair decision. It's been a rough 24 hours. We are recording this after finding out, I guess, about 12, 13 hours ago, as of the time of recording, that Russia has begun its full invasion of Ukraine. We are going to talk about the operative legal standards, what it means to commit war crime, to violate international law. But I have friends in Ukraine at the moment, you know, communicating via WhatsApp and talking about hearing bombs in the close distance. We have, for the last show, we have 38 listeners in Ukraine. Those are real people right there. So if this is affecting you, get safe, write to us, talk about it. We're trying to do everything we can.
Yeah, this day and age, it's just so weird and horrifying that you can browse social media and see everybody's firsthand accounts of getting essentially bombed. What a world we live in. Everything that anyone's doing just seems so inadequate.
Yeah.
At least we can learn about some of the law involved and maybe see internationally what the world can do about it. I don't know.
Our job is to educate, and hope we do that today.
In less bad news, yesterday we recorded a really fun Lot Awful Movies, and we are, I'm working to get that. We keep doing it on this, like, right when I record this show as well, and editing both is hard.
Here, have a 2-hour lamb plus, yeah. You know, I don't want to go out on a huge limb, but it's possible that this episode might run a little long, today. Yeah.
Okay, I so mean, you'll have a Lot of Movies sometime in April.
You will.
But in the meantime, if you'd like to watch the movie that we watched, it is Presumed Innocent, a Harrison Ford movie. Great cast from 1990 that neither of us had ever heard of.
No.
But nonetheless, was a lot of fun. So if you want to watch that while waiting for me to finish 10 hours of editing, Presumed Innocent. You can watch it on Amazon. I think
polarizing movie. Ooh. Among the two of us. So you'll have to wait. One of us thought it was mostly rotten, but got fresher after having discussed it over the course of doing a lot of awful movies, and the other thought the exact opposite.
Yeah. And one more announcement on the content front for us, the Q&A, it's the end of another month. What do you know? Well, it's a short one, so it came quickly.
Damn February's.
Yeah. So we have our monthly Q&A that we do each and every month for patrons, where they get to ask the questions. However, everybody can come join. It's a lot of fun. Come hang out. Come interact on the chat. But patrons get to ask the questions on the Q&A thread. And of course, please help me out by voting on the questions that you want to hear answered. That just hit that little heart button. That's a good indicator to me of what you guys want to hear the answer to. So patrons, make sure to do that. And the Q&A itself will be March 1st, Tuesday, March 1st, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. Going to be a ton of fun. Please come follow the YouTube account if you want to see when we go live. We also throw out the link on all the Patreon and the social media. So looking forward to that on Tuesday.
And one more piece of news breaking today, the North Carolina court has confirmed a set of maps in connection with the dispute over North Carolina's gerrymandered political maps. That has implications for the Madison Cawthorn challenge. We'll be talking about that next week. Too much to cover today, but that is on our radar. We will tell you what that means. We will get to that next week.
Down. Down. All right, our first segment today, Andrew, is sort of a holding Trump accountable segment. What's the news on, I think the Supreme Court just slapped down again an attempt for the 1-6 documents to be not shared out. Didn't this already happen? What am I thinking of?
So what you're thinking is that we covered the Supreme Court's refusal to grant an injunction stopping the National Archives from turning over the tranches of documents. But they were still considering separately Trump's petition for certiorari on the merits.
Okay, that is what I was thinking of.
Because I love reading Supreme Court orders, particularly like pages and pages that say things like 21-932, Trump v. Thompson, the petition for writ of certiorari is denied. That's all it says. But I happen to know what that means, and I happen to be able to share that with you, which is that's it. That's the end. That is Donald Trump's challenge to the 1-6 committee saying that they don't have the authority to subpoena the National Archives for presidential records that the subsequent administration has validly said are not covered by executive privilege. They've lost. They've lost. The National Archive is going to be turning over everything that it has been authorized to turn over by the Biden administration. Unambiguous good news and a good way to start this show, I guess.
Yeah, we could use it. We could use the good news. Do we have any more good news or does it turn to the bad news now?
Yeah, well, so also in connection with the 1-6 committee, we have private litigation by other potential witnesses, including the architect of the insurrection, John Eastman. We've talked about that. He's the guy who wrote the legal memo that said, you know, here's how Mike Pence can use ambiguities in the Electoral Count Act to subvert the democratic will of the people. And he has challenged the production of his documents, saying that they are attorney-client privilege that has been opposed by the 1-6 committee on multiple grounds, including a crime fraud exception, bro. but also, right, you have multiple non-lawyers in the room. That vitiates the privilege, right?
Even I know that.
Yeah, this is all over a privilege law, right? So in other words, Eastman produced the documents that I guess don't make him look that bad. I don't know. But has held back on about 140 documents. And what you do is you produce a privilege log. It's an Excel sheet. And it says the subject of the memorandum, the authors, the recipients, the nature of the privilege. And he has turned that, as well as the documents themselves, over to the court. They are litigating it right now. I mention this because I keep calling out Foley and Lardner on our Twitter account. I'm going to do so every day until I hear back from them or until my firm has got to spend its resources filing another amicus brief. But John Eastman is lying in open court. He is co-counseled with Cleta Mitchell. You might remember her as showing up on the Brad Raffensperger call representing Donald Trump. That was a real surprise to her law firm at the time, Foley and Lardner, a coat factory kind of firm, right? That said, we've looked through our client list and Donald Trump is not one of them. And Cleta Mitchell was like, oh, did I forget
just,
to?
Yeah, just picked up some side yard work, you know, make a few bucks in my spare time.
That is a violation of the ethics rules. It's a violation of firm policy. And they fired her ass. Huh. Eastman and Mitchell are now claiming that, of course, that it's the woke mob and they're conservatives. And she was actually fired because once, I guess this is technically correct, but not the best kind of technically correct. It says she was pressured to resign once news came out that she represented Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, that is what happened.
Yeah, because the firm was not informed of that. So that's super terrible. And then they're lying in court and nobody has the incentive to correct it. Foley and Lardner could send a letter to the court, which is what I keep tweeting at them to do. If you're on Twitter, amplify that. Tweet back at Foley and Lardner. They've got a person monitoring that Twitter account, and that somebody is looking at it. So they only have 9,500 followers. Like, we can make a difference with respect to
for
that.
Somebody like me who has a hard time following all these names you're throwing around. Who's Foley and Lardner specifically? I thought it was a different law firm at first that you were talking about that fired.
Yeah, Foley and Lardner is Cleta Mitchell's former firm. They had to fire Cleta Mitchell because of the lying. She is now saying, I wasn't fired for lying. I was fired because the woke mob, you know, came after me for representing Trump. And that is a load of, you know, that's a load of horse shit. You can, you can bleep it or not. I don't care.
That stays in.
Yeah, exactly. And it is galling. And Foley and Lardner have every reason to want to correct the record.
Well, then why haven't they?
I don't know. Let's hold their feet to the fire.
I was going to ask if it's the opposite and they don't really have incentive to do that because it's kind of like they've brushed it off their hands and they're kind of done with the situation.
There is, look, coat factory style law firms are inherently conservative, right? You want to bring on the highest number of ultra wealthy clients, institutional corporate clients that you can. And so you're incentivized to kind of mumble as much as possible because, you know, who knows when it turns out that one of your potential clients is, you know, very, very liberal or very, very conservative. And you want to just chameleon your way to be like, oh, yeah, we've always liked pillows. Yeah, right. So I get that. They want to have a low profile, but this is a case in which they are being misrepresented by the architect, the legal architect of the insurrection. And I get that they'd rather just kind of be like, let's pretend like this isn't happening, but they need to correct this. And if they don't, we will. We will file an amicus brief in this case. So
darn right we will. I'll get right on that. Yeah, I'm going to start working on it.
You should. You should. Absolutely.
Well, that is something you would see if you followed Opening Arguments at OpenArgs on Twitter. There's another story here that you also tweeted about. This seems just like total bad news. These resignations, Manhattan DA, what's going on here? Why did these people resign? Is this a bad sign for getting any sort of justice on Trump?
It is. This is a terrible, terrible sign. I do not want to sugarcoat it. I know I'm Optimist Prime. This is hopefully us earning our cred with you as telling it like it is. So New York Times broke a story yesterday, Wednesday, that Casey Dunn and Mark Pomerantz, those are the two line prosecutors on the Manhattan District Attorney's investigation into Donald Trump for criminal tax fraud related to his real estate. The New York Times is saying, we can't confirm this with any other source, the New York Times is saying that they resigned because the incoming DA, Alvin Bragg, quote, has doubts about moving forward with the criminal fraud case against Trump. So people are reading that and going, well, does this mean? Look, even if we didn't have that bit of reporting, discount that because we don't have a second source. That would be what I would infer from if it just came through, Dunn and Pomerantz resign. Your line prosecutors don't just resign so that somebody who's not familiar with the case after 2 years of investigation can come in and take over. This means a decision, what we call a declination decision, is coming. Mm. The office is going to say, we decline to indict Donald J. Trump in connection with real estate fraud. You should be disappointed. That's a terrible decision. My best guess from behind the scenes, if you want to know, should we storm Alvin Bragg's office? No. But my best guess is that they just couldn't flip Alan Weisselberg.
Do you have to? I mean, this these crimes seem so obvious to everybody looking. Like, he exaggerates the values of stuff when he's trying to secure loans, and when, you know, when tax time comes, then all of a sudden, this is worthless, this is nothing.
That's the argument Dunn and Pomerantz are making. So if you want to envision this like a, you know, season one Law and Order episode, Dunn and Pomerantz are in Bragg's office and they're saying, look, we can do this. We can authenticate these. We can go forward. It's a straightforward story. I know it's a financial crime picture. Law and Order's Adam Schiff as Bragg going, do you got Weisselberg? Is he going to authenticate the documents? And they're like, well, no. And he's like, all right, well then make the deal or dismiss the case. Mm. And that would be my best estimate of what's going on, is that from the top down, you can understand from a managerial perspective the idea that financial cases are super complex to take before a jury in the first place. That's why they brought in Mark Pomerantz. He was not a member of the Manhattan DA's team. He was in private practice. They brought him in because of his experience in prosecuting financial cases. And you can see like sort of the skepticism of this is really, really hard to do. And it is, right? As somebody who has had some involvement in these kinds of cases, it's a challenge to do that before a jury, to start talking about numbers and accounting and X and Y and Z. And if you have to go to a hostile witness to authenticate 800 different documents, I agree. It's going to be a hard case to do. It seems very clear to me that Dunn and Pomerantz were like, yeah, this is going to be really, really hard, but we're up for the challenge. And I think Bragg said, again, you want to be most fair to Bragg. What I would envision is him saying, right, but if we bring the case and you lose, that would be way worse than just not bringing the case at all.
I'm tired of that being the excuse every single time with everything related to Donald Trump.
I don't agree with that decision. Okay. I don't defend what happened. I just want to tell you, you need to know, is this the sign that Donald Trump is not going to get criminally indicted in New York? Yes. Yes, it is. Oh, anybody man. Saying otherwise is even more optimist prime than I am. Where you want to set your sights now is Fulton
Georgia.
County. Fulton County, Georgia, DA Fannie Willis. Let's see what happens there. That is a slam dunk case, as I've said from the very beginning. So that's where I'm holding out hope. Close the door in Manhattan. Folks have asked about the cooperation with Tish James in the New York Attorney General's office. That's a civil case. So, you know, yes, that's going to go forward. Tish James is not going to take over this investigation for a lot of reasons, too complicated to kind of get into right here. And Trump is going to come out way ahead on fraud, right? Like, you know, even if they get a ton of civil penalties, it's still going to be a net benefit to him. So, you know, it's kind of hard for me to get worked up over maybe he will face some penalties in connection with that civil proceeding. If that motivates you, great. But no, you have a right to be disappointed here.
Okay, Andrew, main story here. Well, co-main story, I suppose. What's going on with this Abbott letter?
Texas Governor Greg Abbott sent a one-page letter to the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services that once again explains how Republicans are using trans people as a political football for cheap gain in that state. Obviously, our hearts go out to our trans listeners, to trans people everywhere. I want to tell you that this is largely political stunt. It does not mean that it's not horrible and that the people behind it are not awful human beings. It does mean that from a practical perspective, I do not think that things are likely to get materially worse, other than, you know, if you're a trans person in Texas, you're already the political football. And I can't emphasize how angry and upset we are over that. So let's explain. The letter says, in light of a recent determination by OAG opinion KP-0401, I am instructing you, the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services, as the governor, to review all of your records to point out where gender reassignment surgery is now definitively child abuse in the state of Texas and report that to me. Huh. The very first question you would ask is, what the hell is OAG opinion KP-0401? And the answer is, it's a letter. It's a letter written by an idiot. That idiot is Attorney General Ken Paxton. Oh, and so here's what happened. Under Texas law, a subset of people are allowed to ask questions of the Attorney General. One of them is sitting members of Congress. So right-wing monster and fellow idiot Matt Krause is in the Texas state legislature. He is running for district attorney. And of course, he's doing so by demonizing trans people. Oh, did I mention he's a Republican? Yeah, no need to mention that. So he wrote to Ken Paxton and said, hey, don't you think gender reassignment surgery is child abuse? And Ken Paxton basically replied, do I ever? Right?
Yeah.
But except that even Paxton being Paxton, right, being a lying, horrible human being, the most he could do in this letter is say, well, looking at it XYZ way, such treatments, quote, could be determined by a court to constitute child abuse under the, also quoting here, broad definition of Texas's child abuse statute. So basically what he says is, our child abuse statute has to be construed broadly under the law, and it is possible, and I'm not going to go into the odious, bigoted reasons. They're terrible. You don't need to know that. And so if you construe it super broadly, yes, gender reassignment surgery could constitute child abuse. What has people concerned, and I understand that, is the last page of the opinion. It is chilling. It is terrible. It talks about mandatory reporters, which would include things like school counselors, anybody who has a mandatory duty to report child abuse. That standard under Texas law, that is the Texas Family Code section 261.101A, is, quote, if you have a reasonable cause to believe that a child's physical or mental health or welfare has been adversely affected by abuse or neglect by any person, then you shall immediately make a report as described in the law. Don't take legal advice from a podcast. You know that. I am not representing you as your lawyer, but I am going to say what I believe any lawyer in Texas would tell you if you are a mandatory reporter and you are a pro-trans, that is to say, a decent human being, mm-hmm. as a social worker, a school counselor, a mandatory reporter for whatever reason. You do not know that any trans person has been affected by abuse. That mm-hmm. is not what 0401 says. It does not say that, it uses the language sex change, but I'm going to continue to use gender reassignment surgery. It does not say that gender reassignment surgery per se constitutes child abuse. It says a court may find that. Until a court does find that, you do not know that it constitutes, quote, that a child's physical or mental health or welfare, quote, has been adversely affected by abuse, end of quote.
Okay, but also not the lawyer here, so, you know, don't, you can take advice from me. Even if a court did find that, come on. Is this a thing that ethically people should be following, this mandatory reporting on merely being trans?
I think you know where I stand on the ethics of this. I want to tell you on the legality of mandatory reporting. So I take your point, which is that even if there was a court decision, this might be an instance, this ought to be an instance in which you would exercise civil disobedience and say, mm-hmm. hey, I'm not complying with that decision. There will not be court decisions that hold this. Ken Paxton is a moron. No court would so hold. The reasoning in his letter is as dumb as anything Ken Paxton, and bigoted and awful as anything Ken Paxton has ever written. The question is, are you going to lose your job as a school counselor mm-hmm. if you don't report the trans kid that's in your class? And the answer to that, again, I'm not your lawyer. If you remain terrified after this, talk to a lawyer. The answer to that is no. You will not lose your job over a failure to mandatory report, even under the worst possible application of this. Now, I need to say, attorney general opinion letters are binding on the interpretation of executive agencies in the state of Texas. So the reasoning that gender reassignment surgery could constitute child abuse is now something that if you work in the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services, you have to do your job in light of this stupid thing that Ken Paxton has written. And again, all I can say with respect to that is, let's organize and turn Texas blue. Let's make sure that bigots like this don't hold office anymore.
Well, Beto is running to replace him. Yep. So, yep. So I feel like he's the front runner. Regardless,
I feel like that
whoever's the Democratic front runner, we got to get behind them.
Yep. Get to work. But in terms of, is this going to result in an immediate change? My view is that this is not going to result in an immediate change. I wish I could say that that would remove our trans listeners, our trans friends, from being the target of gross and disgusting political attacks. Nothing I can say is going to do that. But I do not think that we are going to have a legal regime that penalizes you as a school counselor, as a social worker.
This show is brought to you by Athletic Greens. It's time to tell you once again, I don't have a lot of time in the morning. No, that's a lie. Again, I keep telling you the same lie. I have plenty of time in the morning. Don't have the wherewithal. And if you're like me and you want something to get your day started on the right foot, try Athletic Greens. I love a good health drink. The greener, the better, I think. What I love about Athletic Greens is it's basically an all-in-one nutritional insurance. And I like to think about it that way. Because, look, I don't remember which vitamins do what. I'm as bad at remembering vitamins as I am at which amendment is what. You know, there's roughly 50 of them, and can't remember what ones are good or bad. That's like vitamins. Same thing. I can't keep that all straight. I don't want to keep that all straight. Athletic Greens is your insurance and your reason to not have to keep up with all that. Athletic Greens supports better sleep quality and recovery, supports mental clarity and alertness, and Athletic Greens uses the best of the best products based on the latest science with constant product iteration and third-party testing. And here's the thing about Athletic Greens. If you tried to line up all these supplements and vitamins on your own, the founder tried this. It cost him $100 a day to get all this different stuff for his gut health and his vitamins that he was trying to do. That's why he invented this. It's way cheaper than getting all that stuff yourself. So take advantage of his legwork there. Get your optimal nutrition routine all in one delicious scoop. So right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition, especially heading into the flu and cold season. It's just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and five free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/opening. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/opening to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance.
The Russian military has begun a brutal assault on the people of Ukraine. Without provocation, without justification, without necessity, this is a premeditated attack.
Okay, on to the main news, the invasion of Ukraine. What can you tell us about this? What's the opening arguments explainer on what's going on?
Here's my opening arguments explainer. The principle of national sovereignty is the cornerstone of international law. And so when you say that Russia has committed war crimes and violated international law, that's the basis for saying so. When I said that late last night on social media, I got pushback from some of our listeners. And I get one level the argument that they're making, which is, boy, the U.S. seems to have unclean hands with respect to this.
Sure.
We are a colonial, monstrous nation, and who are we to start talking about sovereignty? And so I want to weave together a story about one of the very worst things the United States has ever done and bring you around to the point where recognizing that activity requires recognizing the principle that I stated at the outset, which is that the bedrock of international law is sovereignty. And so regardless of how dirty you think our hands are, and they are super dirty, wait till you hear the story, you still need to be firmly on the side of this is naked aggression and this needs to be resisted with whatever practically we can organize.
It's a complete non sequitur argument. I can't wait for the story of the explainer, but like just logically speaking, before even getting to that, because we did bad things, therefore everybody gets to do it. Like we started it, so anybody gets out. Yeah, I guess it's free for all. No more sovereignty because we got away with some terrible crap. And also, I think it matters who we're talking about. You know, it's one thing to say America as a unit did all these bad things throughout the centuries. But I mean, I think that can be a little bit unfair. For one thing, many people out there didn't support the Iraq War, other invasions, never supported it, and are on perfectly fine ethical ground wanting there to be consequences for this invasion of Ukraine. That's not, it would be one thing if George W. Bush was like, hey, man, come on. Then you could be like, yeah, that's a little hypocritical, George W. Bush. And maybe he is doing that. I don't know. But
Bill Kristol is doing it. He's a huge hypocrite. And we have called him out as a monster, you know, throughout the duration of opening arguments, right?
Yeah.
We preface that with, God help me, I agree with Bill Kristol on the rare occasions where I have. So, yeah. Excellent point.
It's not the George W. Bush administration anymore. It's a new administration. And furthermore, for there to be any help for the people who desperately need it in this world, unfortunately, it's going to have to come from people with unclean hands, because honestly, who has perfectly clean hands internationally in any of this? So that's the only way. Oh, sorry. The last point I was going to make on that is that's directly Putin's argument as well. His speech, his insane speech that was a precursor to this.
Right before the troops stormed across the border.
Yeah. It was a litany of, and honestly, it's genius in an evil way. I mean, all he did was list the U.S.'s sins, you know, in the past, and honestly is right about a lot of that. But he's relying on that in order to commit atrocities. So don't help him with that, is all I'm saying.
Let me amplify that a little bit, because we always get misunderstood when I make this point. I am engaging with the argument being made by some of our listeners as a good faith argument. I do get it. So when I say this, I am not dismissing everyone whose initial reaction is, well, okay, like this is bad, but like the U.S. has been bad. I don't really see why we should get involved. I am not immediately dismissing that as Russian propaganda. Okay. I am taking your argument at face value. But I want to tell you this. We know from the Senate intelligence reports that Russian troll farms right now are flooding Facebook and other social media outlets with Russian bots and individuals who are repeating these kinds of arguments. And so I'm not saying you are being disingenuous by making the argument. You may firmly believe it, but you are repeating the same arguments that are being employed by troll farms. And let's not give aid and comfort to our international rival that has just committed a war crime. So what do I mean by has committed a war crime? What does it mean to violate international law? As it turns out, there's a relatively straightforward answer to what that means. Hmm. The UN Charter, Chapter 14, describes how we know what international law is. And the answer is actually kind of genius in its simplicity. Article 92, the International Court of Justice shall be the principal judicial organ of the United Nations. It shall function in accordance with the annexed, that means attached, statute, which is its principles of how it works, which is based upon the previous entity, which was called the Permanent Court of International Justice in a rather amusing, like the permanent court lasted a very short period of time. So basically, international law is whatever the International Court of Justice says that it is. So how does that work? Article 93, all members of the United Nations are ipso facto parties to the statute of the International Court of Justice. So in joining the UN, you say we are parties to the ICJ. Article 94, each member of the United Nations undertakes to comply with the decision of the ICJ in any case to which it is a party. Okay, so the ICJ has jurisdiction over every member of the UN. Put a pin in that one. Article 95 says nothing in the present charter shall prevent members of United Nations from entrusting the solution of their differences to other tribunals by virtue of agreements already in existence, which may be concluded in the future. Okay, that is just you can find other ways to solve disagreements. Mm. And then Article 96, the General Assembly or the Security Council may request the ICJ to give an advisory opinion on any legal question. So that's it. There are a couple other sentences, but basically that's how the UN says we determine what international law is. So remember that annexed statute? The statute of the International Court of Justice, in turn, describes how the ICJ makes that determination, right? So, okay, the UN says international law is whatever the ICJ says it is. How does the ICJ determine what's international law? Article 38 of the ICJ says basically there are five sources that the ICJ can look at to determine what international law is. Article 38.
Magna Carta.
No. The court, whose function it is to decide in accordance with international law such disputes as are submitted to it, shall apply A, international conventions, whether general or particular, establishing rules expressly recognized by the contesting states. Okay, so that is, you might expect, international law consists of treaties, actual agreements made by and between nations, you know, that have been properly ratified by those countries and to which they have agreed. That's sort of the equivalent of statutory law. You agreed to the Paris Accords. The Paris Accords said you're going to reduce CO2 emissions by 5%. You didn't. You increased CO2 emissions by 1,000,000,000%. You violated the express terms of that treaty. But there are four other sources. B, international custom as evidence of a general practice accepted as law. C, the general principles of law recognized by civilized nations. Or D, subject to the provisions of Article 59, we're not going to go into those, judicial decisions and the teachings of the most highly qualified publicists of the various nations as subsidiary means for the determination of rules of law. In other words, what do the smartest lawyers in your jurisdiction think international law means? We can use that as a secondary source. And you put B, C, and D together, and it forms a body that is called CIL, Customary International Law. And the important thing to recognize here is that customary international law is every bit as binding as a treaty. It is the equivalent. It is just as valid a source of legal determination. Oh, the fifth source. I love this one. I just want to do a little sidebar on it. It says, this provision shall not prejudice the power of the court to decide a case ex aequo et bono if the parties agree thereto. And that's just because I love hitting you with some Latin.
Yeah.
Ex aequo. I think it's aequo. A-E-Q-U-O. It's been a long time since I took my semester of Latin in high school. But so ex aequo et bono means according to the right and good. So in other words, if the parties agree to it, they can come before the ICJ and say, yeah, do the thing that you think makes the most sense here, which is, you know, longstanding OA principle from way back in at the dawn of recorded time, 2016, August of 2016, those halcyon days. So what is customary international law? The first principle of customary international law is the sovereignty of nations. That is, nation states stand in relationship to each other under the United Nations in the same way that individuals stand in relationship to each other under their national governments.
Okay. But as determined by who? Is Taiwan a nation? How does the law recognize? And let's use a different example. Let's say one of the most red states of the U.S. decides, and say they even have majority support within the state, that they want to be independent. How does international law treat that? How do they evaluate that?
Yeah, and the answer is that it is a function of how the membership views the sovereignty claims of the actor making them. So Taiwan, for example, has been the subject of litigation before the ICJ. And ultimately, the General Assembly voted to not recognize Taiwan as the legitimate government of China and to recognize the People's Republic of China instead, over massive objections by not just the Taiwanese, but by other nation states. And that is, if you want to argue that that is a weakness of the sovereignty system, I'm with you. That's a weakness of the sovereignty system. There is, notwithstanding Russian propaganda, there is no dispute regarding Ukraine's status as a sovereign nation. None, zero. The United Nations has recognized Ukraine as a sovereign member nation, has never had grounds to challenge that. So that's the background. And now the story. Our story begins in 1912. The pro-U.S. president of Nicaragua, Juan Jose Estrada, resigned under pressure. That pressure being that he was basically a U.S. puppet, right? He was bankrupting the country by taking on all of these U.S. loans that they couldn't repay. The United States had wanted to build a canal in Nicaragua and continued to want to do that at this time. And the populace was like, hey, man, you don't seem to be acting in our national interests. You seem to be acting in the U.S. national interest. So he resigned.
I'm not a historian, Andrew, but my impression of learning more about the history over the years is this same story happened in basically every single country south of us. Is that almost every
in South America? This is pretty. There's a reason I'm telling this story. It is, you know, tale as old as time. Right?
Yeah, lest anybody think this is like a one-off.
But wait till we get to some of the details.
Okay.
So Estrada resigned, but his even more conservative and pro-U.S. vice president Adolfo Diaz then took over. And then the Nicaraguan Congress was like, all right, fine, it's 1912. Your term expires in 1913. And under their constitution, they had the right to vote for the successor. And so they picked the liberal candidate, Luis Mena. The United States said, yeah, we don't recognize that decision. Why? And that was not explained.
To which the citizens of Nicaragua must have been like, what? Okay.
Right,
why
right.
do we give a shit? Like, yeah.
And it turned out to not be the greatest kind of snap decision by the U.S. because Luis Mena was also general of the army and minister of war. So, you know, he could do more than just send sternly worded crunch wraps at the time. Diaz then sent a telegram to the United States and was like, hey, you you announced that this was illegitimate, and now the general of the army is massing troops outside, and I'm pretty sure that I'm going to get overthrown and killed. And in response, the U.S. sent warships, thousands of Marines. We crushed MENA's forces and basically ran the country for 4 years. By the end of 1916, we managed to install a pro-U.S. puppet, Chamorro, Emiliano Chamorro Vargas. Chamorro is the family name. They're going to hear a lot of the family name because of subsequent history. And I am oversimplifying here. So
yeah,
feel free to write in.
I need you to tell word for word the last 100 years of this history in 40 minutes.
Chamorro, pro-U.S. Shockingly, things did not stay stable during Chamorro's regime. The U.S. sent more troops down in 1927. Diaz came back into power, and around this time, 1927, there arose a true national hero. And when I say true national hero, I don't mean Andrew Torres was inspired. I mean, there are statues of this guy across the country. Mm. Right? He is the George Washington of Nicaragua. His name is Augusto Cesar Sandino. Sandino organized the resistance to the U.S. occupation, which was a pretty significant challenge, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
He declared war on the United States, which, again, pretty impressive for a guy with an army that ranged from several hundred to several thousand. And so was early guerrilla campaign tactics in the 1920s, 1930s. And he cast that in broader anti-imperialist terms. He brought in a Honduran diplomat to be basically his secretary of state. This is a time in which, you know, part of our U.S. colonialist strategy was pitting Latin American nations against one another. And Sandino was also, again, outspokenly pro-American. There was zero evidence that he ever took American hostages. He vowed never to harm American citizens who were in Nicaragua, right? Like, he was just, you know, hey, U.S. should get out. In fact, his demands in 1927 were the resignation of the pro-U.S. stooge, President Diaz, the withdrawal of U.S. troops, and new elections to be supervised by a community of Latin American nations. And also abrogating the Chamorro agreement with William Jennings Bryan to build the canal in Nicaragua. Very, very important at the time. Was a huge giveaway to the United States. It was terrible for the Nicaraguan people. Wound up not being necessary because the U.S., due to the instabilities, decided not to proceed with the Nicaraguan canal. But that was still a live issue, 1927. His guerrilla war campaign wages for 6 years. Now it's 1933, and Sandino, he's now General Sandino, managed to force the United States to withdraw their military from Nicaragua. Wow. Now, he was aided by, the Great Depression in the United States.
Right.
He was aided by the election of FDR, who was probably thinking about the Great Depression when cutting back on our military adventurism. FDR implemented what was known as the Good Neighbor Policy, which officially said that we were going to be non-interventionist in the internal affairs of Latin American nations. Again, feel free to write in. I am not suggesting that FDR fulfilled that promise to the letter. I am suggesting it marked a public shift away from we're going to treat these as client states.
Mm-hmm.
And oversaw a free and fair election that resulted in a marked change from everything to date in somebody else being named president, right? Mm. Like that's part of why Sandino is considered a national hero, right? Never seized power for himself.
Wow.
The person who was elected was liberal Juan Bautista Sacasa. Now, U.S. is getting out 1933, 1934, but they've been running things for 2 decades. And one of the things they've been running was the National Guard, the Guardia Nacional, which was organized, trained by the U.S. Marines.
Boy, this really feels a lot like Afghanistan in some ways.
The more things change.
Yeah.
So one of the last acts of our outgoing ambassador, Matthew Hanna, was to ensure that Antonio Somoza Garcia would be appointed the director of the Guardia Nacional. Okay, he was a politically connected member of the National Guard at the time. That was 1933. In 1934, Sandino, the hero, met with incoming President Sacasa. And Sacasa said, look, we'd like to consolidate power. You have a guerrilla army. It seems like you've accomplished your objectives. So maybe you want to stand those guys down. And those talks went great. Sandino said, yep, I pledge loyalty to this government. Give me 3 months. I'm going to disarm all of the forces. And the major concession he got was squatters' rights in an uninhabited, I don't want to say uninhabited, but in a sparsely inhabited area of Nicaragua called the Coco River Valley. So look, yeah, I've got all these militia types here in the field. They're ready to, you know, roll up their sleeves and become farmers and homesteaders. Give them some land and we will disband the paramilitary revolutionary forces. While they were leaving those talks, it's February 21, 1934. Somoza, the U.S.-appointed head of the National Guard, had six hand-picked thugs drag Sandino and his brother and two other generals out of the car and shot them in the back of the head.
Wow.
Legend has it that the assassins took Somoza's head to the U.S. government, to the CIA as a trophy. That is not confirmed, but that is part of how the story is told.
Mm.
Somoza then sent out the orders and murdered the rest of Sandino's forces. They never got a chance to go settle in the Coco River Valley. And over the next 2 years, basically eliminated all of the military opposition, forced President Sarcasa to resign. And in the 1936 election, somehow that wound up being a nip and tuck race that Somoza won 107,201 to 100.
Yeah, that sounds realistic.
So yeah, right. So Somoza then took power on January 1st, 1937. He immediately amended the Constitution to centralize power in himself. And he and his corrupt family would rule as autocratic strongmen for 4 decades.
Wow.
He is the kind of corrupt monster that Donald Trump would have loved and probably did. So how about this one? In World War II, Nicaragua declared on behalf of the Allies. Okay, that's good, right? They sent zero troops to Europe. They did get lend-lease military equipment from the United States, which they used to repress their own people. And here's the real Trumpian part. Somoza was already, like Trump, astonishingly wealthy as the heir to a coffee plantation. During World War II, he had the government seize all German-owned properties in Nicaragua and sold them to himself. So by 1944, he was the single largest landowner in all of Nicaragua. He owned 51 cattle ranges, 46 coffee plantations, basically everything of value in the country. When I tell you the percentage of the country's wealth that his family owned slightly later in the story, you will not believe the number. I had to look at multiple sources to confirm this. So Somoza named himself the director of the country's largest state-owned railroad, the Pacific Railroad, and then ordered the railroad to move his coffee and beef from across the country for free. Yeah,
this guy's running everything. He gave everything to himself.
What's left is a great question, because what he couldn't personally steal from the land, he gave away to U.S. corporations to come mine gold, to slash and burn timber, to harvest rubber trees. You know, he lacked the infrastructure to be able to like develop those factories. Right. You know, you can seize a coffee plantation and run it with essentially slave labor or peones labor, but you can't build up the infrastructure to do it. So instead, gave those away to U.S. companies who paid him personally in what were called presidential commissions. He would make imports of certain goods illegal and then fund and develop the illegal entity that would then sell those goods nationally and then not prosecute them. He would take bribes from organized crime. So by 1950...
He's like the Michael Jordan of corruption.
Yeah. He was one of the richest men in the world. You can't last forever on that. So he was assassinated in 1956, succeeded by his son, Donald Trump Jr. his son, Luis Somoza. Luis Somoza was slightly less autocratic, no less corrupt. He provided the launch point for the Bay of Pigs, for example. So the CIA called up their buddy Somoza, trained those operatives in Nicaragua before launching towards Cuba. Luis Somoza managed to orchestrate kind of a handful of Somoza-friendly puppet rulers before being succeeded by his brother, Anastasio Somoza, good friend to Richard Nixon. I think this summarizes him. His most famous quote is, "I don't want an educated population. I want oxen."
Oh, boy.
Sole authoritarian ruler of Nicaragua. So the Somozas, this is the part that I've told you a lot. They owned a company called Plasmapheresis. Plasmapheresis, true to its name, collected blood plasma from the poorest of Nicaraguan citizens and sold abroad to the United States and Europe. Half a liter of blood would sell for 35 Nicaraguan cordobas, which is about $5. at the time.
Literally bleeding their own people dry for money. This is, wow.
Managua, capital of Nicaragua, was hit by one of the most powerful earthquakes of the 20th century, a 6.3 magnitude earthquake in 1972. Killed 10,000 people, injured tens of thousands more, left 300,000 people homeless. There are areas of Managua today that haven't been rebuilt 50 years later. And that's largely because Somoza embezzled the funds that were sent internationally to rebuild the city. Plasmapheresis continued to export Nicaraguan blood to Europe in the wake of the earthquake. Jeez. It is, I mean, literally, I cannot imagine worse villainy than this, right? So by 1975, Somoza's family controlled 60% of the economy of Nicaragua. That's a number that you cannot imagine. Three quarters of the population could not read or write. And the handful of autocrats owned literally all of the wealth, a majority, I shouldn't say literally all, but owned 60% of the wealth of this nation. So it should probably not be too surprising that in 1979, they were finally overthrown by the Socialist Party FSLN, the Sandinista National Liberation Front. That was named after our hero, Sandino, right? The Sandinistas. That lasted for about a year and a half. And then in the United States, we elected Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan's CIA immediately organized and began training revolutionaries to overthrow the democratically elected FSLN. These were the Contras. Contra meaning against. And this, again, I cannot tell you strongly enough, was pure imperialism, right? The FSLN held an election in 1984. They won. The U.S. did not care. We sent guns. We sent money. We sent training. We sent officers. That training included explicit instructions to the Contras as to how to carry out targeted assassinations against judges, police, governmental officials. It is as corrupt, as terrible, as bad as you can think. And then we hooked up the Contras with a well-known drug trafficker working for the CIA. And Contra-run drug gangs sold crack in the United States in order to fund their efforts in Nicaragua. I'm not going to talk about the Iran-Contra scandal because this is already going so long. In addition to all of that, from January to March of 1984, the CIA secretly mined three harbors in Nicaragua. These are the three largest ports in the country. Those mines disrupted Nicaraguan shipping. They had no idea where they were, so the country couldn't export goods. Seven vessels were damaged. Nicaraguan fishing boats would blow up when they would hit the mine. You know, so they just killed, you know, Nicaraguan fishermen out there trying. If you want a tiny bit of nostalgia, the mining was actually opposed by some Republicans, including Senator Barry Goldwater, who very famously went to the floor of the Senate. He was the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee at the time. When he read the report, he went to the floor of the Senate and said, "I am pissed off."
Wow.
Back when things would matter.
Yeah, but it didn't matter. I mean, they all got away with it. Reagan's still revered to this day.
Democrats thought and talked about appointing a special prosecutor under the old special prosecutor statute to determine that that violated U.S. law. That went nowhere once Ronald Reagan won 49 states in re-election in the 1984 election. Finally, after 72 years, Nicaragua went to the United Nations. They got a ruling. The UN ruled against the U.S. on 15 counts. Ordered the U.S. to pay reparations. And the basis of that ruling was that the United States breached customary international law by violating the sovereignty of Nicaragua. And then those 15 counts were the multiple ways that we violated their sovereignty.
Did
it just
cap out on 15? They're like, there's plenty more, but there's a cap.
Of course. Training the Contras, laying the mines, the sub-activities that relate to that. It was extensive and damning. And the United States, under Ronald Reagan, responded by saying, yeah, we're not sure that the ICJ has jurisdiction over us. And the ICJ said, oh, yeah, no, we definitely do. Like, that's a question for us to decide. And we decide what we do. And we were like, okay, well, agree to disagree. Then the UN Security Council passed multiple measures enforcing the judgment that the U.S. vetoed. Finally, it went to the floor of the United Nations itself. And that vote was 94-3. The three votes to the contrary were the United States, Israel, and El Salvador, which had a right-wing puppet dictatorship that we had successfully managed to prop up in an illustration. Like, I could tell the El Salvadoran story, and
yeah,
it would be similarly horrible. So 94 to 3, you know, so not exactly a great spot for the U.S. To be in. And to this day, we have declined to recognize the authority of that judgment by the ICJ. So I take two principles away from that. The first is the hard lesson right here, and that is it is very, very difficult to hold a member of the UN Security Council accountable under international law. What we did in Nicaragua was indefensible and horrible and wrong. And if I were president, I would immediately order reparation, right? That we comply with that rule. It's going to be tough. It is going to be unbelievably hard to hold Russia accountable for their naked aggression in Ukraine. But if you think what the U.S. did in Nicaragua was wrong, the legal grounds for that was the violation of the sovereignty of Nicaragua. Nothing else. There's no other violation of international law upon which you can hang your hat. And if you think that nations are sovereign, that deserve not to have an imperialist power come in and say, we don't like this government, we want to put in this guy instead, and we want... If you think that there is any ground for that, you have to be on the side of humanity in opposition to what Russia is doing here. There's no amount of, like, whataboutism or, like, this is bad. I agree. Like, the invasion of Iraq was, you would not find somebody more opposed to our efforts to conflate post 9/11 and go into Iraq. It's terrible and it's awful. But one of the reasons why it's terrible and awful is the principle of sovereignty. And that's what I just want to encourage folks to recognize and stand up for, and stand up for unambiguously. Are there problems with it? Hell yes, there are problems with it. You know, you asked the right question. Let's talk about, you know, Taiwan versus the People's Republic of China. Absolutely. Okay. It is not a perfect system, but it is the system, the bare minimum that we've come into agreement that is meant to stop 70 years of atrocities like this.
Sure. And, I hate to be the Negatron as always, but the story you told me is about how nothing happened and we just were like, no, we don't recognize that judgment. That's a pretty dismal picture.
I'm called upon to Optimist Prime myself here a little bit. That decision, while we've never paid the reparations, that decision did have consequences in the way in which the United States saw itself and related to the world. We have not subsequently mined harbors where we could have, where we did. We have not subsequently engaged in the same level. You know, you want to talk about the invasion of Iraq? I 100% agree that that was monstrous and awful, but notice that there was zero justification given, right? That at least involved, I can't believe this is going to get taken terribly out of context here. It involved Colin Powell committing war crimes to the UN Security Council, going forward and identifying fake maps where famously a baby formula factory was displayed as a known chemical weapons factory. Okay. It involved manufacturing of evidence. The fact that they had to present and manufacture that evidence, in my view, is a step forward. In Nicaragua, it was just, no, we don't like the ruling Sandinista government is pro-Soviet. So we're going to set up and train guerrilla warriors to overturn that, despite the fact that they keep getting reelected. Again, maybe I'm too much of an international realist, but to me, that represents a real difference. To me, that represents a consequence of a type, not enforcing the judgment, but changing, including in the recognition of what constitutes appropriate national conduct, the kind of, yeah, okay, like we're not gonna talk about that anymore. And that is at least some progress. And so I don't know that I endorse the idea that it did nothing. I certainly believe it should do more, but I don't know that I endorse that it did nothing.
How do you think this will be applied here? What do you think will happen? The questions I was going to ask you heading into this about the international law, the UN, that the framework we're laying out is, okay, that's all well and good to have this law that you described where it comes from. How is it enforced? Who enforces it? And I know the veto is always a problem. There's like, if there's enough countries, like one or two, I know there's a problem with Israel. You know, it's always like, well, what Israel's doing is horrible to the Palestinians, but there's just the U.S., it's just a permanent veto on any consequences. How does that function here?
You could kick Russia off the Security Council, for example.
How the hell are they on the Security Council?
They possess the seat formerly held by the Soviet Union, established with the founding of the United Nations. Wow. And there is a real, there's an ICJ case waiting to be had that says, the Soviet Union, that thing's gone. Like, that broke up in the early 1990s. Yeah. And we don't just transfer that out. You now have, you know, the Soviet Union is a bunch of independent sovereign nations, each of which have a vote in the General Assembly. That, in my view, represents a valid move forward. At the end of the day, establishing what the consensus of the international community is significant. And I think that that remains one option. And again, if that were to go forward, you will hear the whataboutism, right? Shouldn't we also kick the U.S. off for what they did in Nicaragua? Yeah, like... Yeah.
Sure.
It's not to say that anybody has clean hands. Shouldn't we kick China off for what they're doing to the Uyghurs? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it isn't that anyone has clean hands. It is, this is a clear violation of principle number one. And if we can't mobilize the entirety of the world unanimously to say, we stand up to this, then what are we doing here in international law? And look, getting every nation to stand up to it, right? Like Germany absolutely needs, you know, their economy is dependent upon the Ukrainian national gas pipeline. And they've said they will not purchase if Russia seizes the natural gas reserves in Ukraine. They won't buy that on the open market from Russia. Sometimes international agreements, sometimes the consensus of world nations actually does matter. And sometimes it matters before going to World War III. I don't know. I don't mean to suggest that I have easy answers for this, but I do have the law. That's the best we can do here.
All of this would have applied for Crimea as well, right? And that seemed to just happen. And then the time passed and it's like, all right, well, I guess Russia just owns Crimea now.
It's part of why I feel so urgent about that now.
Yeah.
What happened in Crimea, and again, you want to talk about U.S. complicity. We've talked about this in connection that Paul Manafort and Tad Devine, U.S. political operatives, went over to Ukraine to help elect a pro-Soviet stooge as president of Ukraine, and that complicated the issue with Crimea. It complicated the issue given the over 50% majority of individuals of Russian origin, right, nationality in Crimea. I do not mean to suggest that these are good arguments. But I mean to suggest that these are reasons why it was treated differently than we ought to treat the outright invasion and bombing of Kyiv today. Those fig leaf arguments, there aren't even figs anymore with respect to this. And so, you know, you cannot fix every historical grievance. You cannot ensure right conduct by horrible imperialist nations that include the United States. But we can fix this. We can identify and go, all right, we at least agree that this is an unambiguous violation of the bedrock, the first principle of customary international law. And if I can get people out there to say like, yeah, look, I want to hear all the arguments. We want to talk about X and Y and Z. But at the end of the day, this is a thing we can do something about. That's how I want to use my voice on this.
All right. Well, quite a deep dive. Interesting history in there. A lot to learn. And yeah, well, once again, I guess put out a call. If you're in Ukraine and you want to write in, let us know anything like that. You know, email us. Our inbox is always open. And hearts go out to you right now. That Absolutely. Is a very scary situation.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3B, Thomas Tries to Be Ethical, taking the ethics exam now and acing it. Today's question is, should you invade a neighboring sovereign nation? As an attorney, I think I'll just answer no. A, no. Did I pass it?
You did. You okay. Absolutely passed it.
All right, what's our real question?
All right, Thomas, an attorney in a 5-lawyer firm learned that one of her partners had charged personal expenses to a client and had fraudulently represented that the expenses were related to the client's representation. After being confronted with evidence of the fraud, the partner resigned. The attorney disclosed the fraud to the client, directed the law firm's billing department to refund the fraudulent charges to the client, and the attorney then asked the client whether the client wanted to disclose the partner's conduct to the disciplinary authority. The client did not object to the disclosure, but left the decision up to the attorney. Is the attorney required to report the partner's conduct to the disciplinary authority? A, yes, because lawyers must report all violations of the rules of professional conduct to disciplinary authorities. B, yes, because the conduct raised a substantial question as to the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer. C, no, because the attorney acted promptly to rectify any damage to the client caused by the partner's conduct. Or D, no, because the attorney owes a continuing fiduciary duty to the partner with respect to matters that occurred during the course of their partnership.
Okay, tough one. This feels like a specific rule I need to know. I'm going to go ahead and eliminate the no answers. I think you probably do have to report the partner's conduct. I would hope that's the rule, because otherwise, you know, they just go out there. Essentially, the Catholic Church, the whole thing. They just go find another person to defraud. I would hope that that's not how the system is supposed to work. I think with this serious of a violation, I would hope that you're supposed to report it. So I'm going to just eliminate the no answers, and I'm going to guess between the yes answers. A, yes, because lawyers must report all violations of the rules of professional conduct to disciplinary authorities. That's very universal language. Could be true, but also, I don't know, maybe, so how would that not be true? Maybe if something's very minor and it's remedied really quickly, maybe you don't have to report that. I could imagine that being a way that the sort of the absolute language of A is wrong. Or B, yes, because the conduct raised a substantial question as to the partner's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer. I'm going to go with B. I think that with A, there's probably some tiny... You know, there's probably some reasonable circumstances where it's like, all right, you brought a pen home accidentally, and so you stole a pen. I don't know, stuff like that, where it's like, okay, I don't have to report this because it's not substantial. But with B, it's like, yeah, this is bad enough to where it's really raising a substantial question as to whether this person can even be a lawyer. So I'm going to go with B, final answer.
All right. And if you want to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess and your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. Hope you're enjoying the ad-free shows, new patrons. The Lot Awful Movies will be coming to you within a few days as soon as I can edit all of this. And also the Q&A thread. Make sure to check that out, new patrons. Utilize your perks. So why don't I go first in thanking our new patrons at patreon.com/law. Thank you to Proctologists United for Kirsten's enema. Okay. Liz Leard, Steve Proper, Jack McCann, Molly Jane Sear, and Bread Alert. Okay. Your turn.
Bread Alert. I like it. And thank you to Crystal M. Siegel, to Alex, the trans girl who spent 37 years in denial. Well, our heart goes out to you, Alex. To Sill, to Sam Karch, Edward Hardy, probably not that Ed Hardy, and Name. I like it. I like it. That's what you have. So sorry, thanks.
I just sent you accidentally the heading of the column.
Well, I so thought maybe not, somebody.
We'll leave it in. Let's thank Name. Name absolutely could have been a patron name. It's like the Washington football team, which it should still be called, you know?
I know. We're such
Name,
fans.
Yeah, or patron yeah. Name would have been a good one. So thank you, Name, for being the heading of the column that I accidentally
That's like our Tomb
Andrew.
Of the Unknown Soldier, right? To yeah. all of our unknown patrons. Thank you. YouTube name. Oh, and that reminds me, I wanted to give a special shout out, long-standing Hall of Fame patron, Salty Seattle Driver on YouTube. They had a credit card, I don't know, whatever. They reached out to us. They've been a patron for a long time, so they didn't get read in their quartile. And thank you, Salty Seattle Driver on YouTube.
And that's our show. Thank you so much for listening again. Oh, God. We wish for safety in Ukraine. Thank you so much for listening. Great deep dive, Andrew, and we'll see you on Monday.
See you then.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use, and be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain, and follow us on Twitter at OpenArgs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.